From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Wherever there's smoke, there's fire. That is true. And so what I want to say to you is that, yes, that I have behaved badly sometimes. Yes, it is true that I was on rowdy movie sets, and I have done things that were not right, which I thought then was playful, but now I recognize that I have offended people.
5 days before the California recall election, Arnold Schwarzenegger has shifted to damage control. Comments published that he made 25 years ago about his admiration for Adolf Hitler, and reports of six women who accused Schwarzenegger of fondling him, of sexually harassing and groping them over the past 3 decades. Today, we'll talk to Arianna Huffington. The Reverend Dan Berrigan joins us to discuss the life of his late brother, Phil Berrigan. He would have been 80 years old this weekend. And 900 Freedom Riders have traveled the country, converging here in New York for a major rally calling for better working conditions for undocumented workers.
Several hundred thousand people are going to join the first ever national mobilization to demand a just and fair reform of our broken immigration policies.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Chief Iraq Weapons Inspector David Kaye yesterday officially told members of Congress that no weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq. Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller said Kaye's report proves the nation's soldiers were put at risk based on a threat that appears not to have existed. Kaye, like many in the Bush administration, maintain even after 6 months of searching, stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons may still show up. Kaye said, quote, "We're not yet at the point where we can say definitively either that such weapon stocks do not exist or that they existed before the war, and our only task is to find where they have gone." Among other things, the inspectors have found no proof that Iraq had mobile biological production trailers, as the Bush administration maintained prior to the invasion. The inspectors did find some equipment that indicated Saddam Hussein might have had plans to someday restart his banned weapons programs. In the classified part of the $87 billion request for Iraq and Afghanistan, $600 million have been earmarked to give to David Kaye and his crew to continue the search. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has come out opposed to the Bush administration's draft resolution on Iraq, thus throwing into doubt what the UN's future will be there. Annan has advocated for allowing the Iraqis to first form a government before writing a constitution. The U.S. has warned against a quick transfer of power. One diplomat told Agence France-Presse, Annan said in a private meeting, he sees no way for two powers to be in charge in Iraq, and that as long as the U.S. is occupying Iraq, it would be difficult for the United Nations to take part. In addition, Annan said the Security Council needs radical reform to remain relevant in a one superpower world. USA Today's reporting Iraqis are now launching an average of 17 assaults a day against the U.S. occupying army, a marked increase in just the past few months. In September, there were days when U.S. forces were attacked over 20 times. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who heads the occupying forces, said yesterday, quote, "The enemy has evolved. It is a little bit more lethal, a little bit more complex, little bit more sophisticated, and in some cases, a little bit more tenacious." The Justice Department was dealt a major setback yesterday in its prosecution of suspected al-Qaeda member Zacharias Massawi. A federal judge barred prosecutors from seeking the death penalty in the case and barred the government from attempting to link Massawi to the September 11th attacks. Judge Brinkema ruled it would be impossible for Massawi to get a fair trial if the Justice Department continues to refuse to allow him to interview captured members of al-Qaeda. Brinkema described Massawi as, quote, quote, remote or minor participant in al-Qaeda's plans against the U.S. The Justice Department may now try to drop the charges against him and move the case to a military tribunal. But analysts warn USA Today that this will make the Justice Department, quote, appear to be shopping for the venue most likely to permit Moussaoui to be executed. And a sign that Attorney General John Ashcroft will not appoint a special independent counsel in the CIA leak case. The Washington Post reports the Justice Department plans to begin interviewing officials within the next few days to find out who illegally leaked the name of a CIA operative to reporters in July. It appears President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, may be among the first to be interviewed. A Justice Department official told the Washington Post the first interviews will be with officials whose names have appeared in news reports about the case. The Justice Department announced it will also focus its investigation on defense and State departments. In a legislative setback to the Bush administration, the Republican-controlled House yesterday rejected a proposal to rewrite the nation's overtime laws by a 221-203 vote. Labor analysts say up to 8 million workers in the U.S. could lose overtime benefits if the Bush-backed measure were passed. 5 days before the October 7th California recall election, Republican candidate Arnold Schwarzenegger was forced to admit yesterday he'd behaved badly toward women. The admission came hours after the Los Angeles Times detailed at least 6 cases where Schwarzenegger had either sexually harassed or sexually molested women over the last 25 years. Meanwhile, Schwarzenegger was forced to deny statements that he made 25 years ago that he admired Adolf Hitler. We'll have more on that in a few minutes. In Afghanistan, 2 Canadian peacekeepers died yesterday when a landmine exploded under their vehicle in Kabul. It was unclear if the mine was set to target international forces. A federal appeals court in San Francisco has overturned a 3-year-old law that forced federal inmates and parolees to give blood samples to be included in an FBI DNA database. On Wednesday, Chicago became the largest city in the country to condemn the USA Patriot Act. Chicago joins over 175 other cities, towns, and countries, as well as 3 states that have passed resolutions against the act. In Peru, the jailed New Yorker Lori Berenson got married yesterday during an 8-minute ceremony in prison. But her husband was barred from attending because he did not yet have a marriage certificate. Berenson is serving 20 years on contested charges that she collaborated with the rebel group, the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement. And South African writer J.M. Coetzee has won the Nobel Prize for Literature for his writings on post-apartheid South Africa. No Woman, No Cry, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 5 days before the October 7th California recall election. Republican candidate Arnold Schwarzenegger has been forced to deny comments he made 25 years ago that he admired Adolf Hitler and wished he too could enjoy a stadium full of screaming fans. Schwarzenegger was quoted as making the comments in a 1975 transcript of an interview while filming the documentary Pumping Iron that made him famous. ABC News, which broadcast the remarks on Thursday, said they were contained in an unpublished book proposal with quotes from what it calls a verbatim transcript of the interview. Asked about his heroes, the young Schwarzenegger was quoted as saying, "I admired Hitler, for instance, because he came from being a little man with almost no formal education up to power. I admire him for being such a good public speaker and for what he did with it," unquote. The transcript continues with Arnold saying he wished he could experience being, quote, like Hitler in the Nuremberg Stadium and have all those people scream at you and just be in total agreement, whatever you say. The story came just hours after the Los Angeles Times reported the accusations of six women who accused Schwarzenegger of sexually harassing and groping them over the past three decades. The actor later apologized at the start of a statewide bus tour in San Diego and acknowledged that he had, quote, behaved badly to women. The tour bus was unfortunately named Predator. The feminist group Code Pink plans statewide protest today demanding Schwarzenegger quit the race. Californians, by an increasingly wide margin, want to replace Democratic Governor Gray Davis with Schwarzenegger, this according to a field poll released today. This is the third this week to show the actor gaining momentum and Davis losing ground. However, voters were surveyed before the latest sexual allegations and reports of admiration for Hitler. 2 days ago, independent candidate Arianna Huffington dropped out of the recall election and is now urging voters to keep Davis in office. Huffington said, quote, "It has become clear to me that over the last 48 hours, that the only way to stop a Republican takeover of California is to vote no on the recall. My supporters are very galvanized to stop Arnold Schwarzenegger." Arianna Huffington joins us on the line right now, writer and commentator who was running as an independent candidate until she quit the race a few days ago. And Juan Gonzalez is just joining us in the studio as well. We called Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign over and over and over again to have Schwarzenegger or someone representing him on the line, but they never got back to us. Welcome, Arianna Huffington.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. And also, Juan, welcome.
Good day, Amy.
That wasn't Juan screaming. It was his headphones. So, Arianna Huffington, what is happening today?
Well, what is happening, Amy, is that for a while now it's become apparent that Arnold Schwarzenegger has spent millions of dollars building a political persona which every day is at greater and greater odds with reality. The Adolf Hitler comment, of course, is absolutely stunning. The reports from different women through many years up to the year 2000 of behavior that is not just offensive, but according to California's penal code, is illegal, has to be incredibly troubling, especially the way it was handled, because you mentioned the apology, Amy, but it all started with a denial in the LA Times by Schwarzenegger's spokesman. Then they moved on to stage two, which was blaming the Democrats for spreading the allegations. Then it moved on to rationalization, saying things like the movie sets are rowdy places and he thought he was being playful. And the apology was very half-hearted and saying things to Candy Crowley at CNN after the formal speech that if these things had happened, he apologized. He doesn't remember. And finally, the brush-off, telling reporters that it was time to move away from California's dirty politics to address California's future. But all that, Amy, comes on top of political contradictions, you know, a man who claims that he will never raise taxes and promises to balance the budget and repeal the car tax without ever telling us what kind of programs he would cut. So that manufactured persona is now beginning to crumble.
What about the reaction so far to your withdrawal from the race and the impact that that's having on the overall outcome?
Well, as I said last night, you know, there was an NBC debate here, and I did the opening statement against the recall. I'm campaigning up and down the state to address not those who have already decided to vote against the recall on grounds of affront to our democracy. I'm campaigning to appeal to the people who rallied around my campaign because they're sick and tired of the current system. They're sick and tired of Sacramento, of our public policy being sold to the highest bidder. And I'm appealing to them to recognize that right now there is a clear and present danger of a Schwarzenegger victory, and that in our idealism, in our wanting to make things better, an idealism which I deeply share, a longing because of which I entered the race in the first place, we may make things much, much worse if we don't confront the harsh fact in front of us and do the only thing right now that can stop Schwarzenegger, which is defeating the recall.
What do you think of Schwarzenegger's response to the Los Angeles Times report on how many women have come forward so far? Six accused him of sexually harassing and groping them.
Well, as I said, the response was really an attempt at damage control. I didn't feel any real apology there, especially the way it was immediately contradicted in that Candy Crowley interview. I think it's very important for people to get a transcript of that, because I watched it last night on CNN. And immediately you see the backtracking. I don't remember what happened all those years ago. I don't know if these things were true. I'm paraphrasing, but that was the sentiment. And so clearly this is purely political. And last night at the debate, you know, I was talking to Daryl Issen, who was there doing the pro-recall speech, and I said, what happened to Republican family values? You know, they only somehow come forward when they have to go after a Democrat, like Bill Clinton, say, on issues of sexual morality. But Amy, I want to make...
Daryl Issa being the man who bankrolled the recall election.
Right. The Republican
campaign.
Congressman from San Diego. But let me just say something, though. There's a huge difference between consensual sex, outside marriage, a huge difference between infidelity, and all those moral questions, which I would argue don't have a place in political discourse. And reports like these, which are really about sexual harassment and acts that are not consensual, and this is really quite Schwarzenegger has to address today. And at our press conference, which we're having here in Los Angeles at 8:30, to release an ad that MoveOn has produced and which is going to start airing today about Schwarzenegger and women. This is the point that many of the women present, many of them lawyers, many of them involved in the feminist majority and other groups working on women's issues, this is the point that they're going to make.
And I would assume that not only among women, but also among, as you mentioned, conservative Republicans who are very much see family values as a major aspect of how they view politics, that this would give them some pause. Those who might have deserted McClintock to vote for Schwarzenegger at the final hour might have some pause now that these further revelations have come out.
Yes, I would have thought so, although there is such a hunger at the moment to gain power, which explains why the Republican establishment, in an unprecedented move, given that there is another Republican in the race who actually corresponds more on the social issues to Republican stated objectives, despite all that, they've really circled the wagons around Schwarzenegger, Republican groups around the state have endorsed him, including county chairman. And so I don't know. I think, frankly, I have much more faith that progressives and independents and moderate Democrats who have been fed up with the Gray Davis administration are going to recognize the danger at hand and come home in terms of voting against the recall. I'm much more optimistic that this will happen than that Republicans will abandon their one imminent chance of taking over the state.
And finally, where do you believe the whole recall idea was hatched? Do you believe it was in California or in Washington?
I have no evidence that it was in Washington. There is no question that the recall would not be on the ballot were it not for Daryl Issa's millions. And I have said throughout the campaign that after October 7th, we need to look again at the recall provision and actually reform it so it's much harder to recall a sitting governor. And even though, you know, I have said many, many critical things against Gray Davis, and I'm taking none of it back because I'm endorsing the anti-recall position. I'm endorsing it because I see the danger of Schwarzenegger and the special interests that are funding him. Amy, I really want to stress that we have pages and pages of contributors to the Schwarzenegger campaign with a huge overlap between them and those who are funding the Bush re-election effort. They include big polluters, big developers, agribusiness, and all the usual sort of corporate rule breakers. And in terms of Washington, there's absolutely no question when you look at the people on his team that this is the Bush economic team, whether it's Mike Boskin or Brad Freeman, who is Bush's very close friend and one of the early pioneers, all of them working for the Schwarzenegger campaign. A Schwarzenegger victory means the Bush victory, and it means handing the state over to the Republicans before the 2004 election. And there is no higher priority for anybody who cares about the country than defeating Bush in 2004. So a first step, unquestionably for me, is defeating Schwarzenegger on Tuesday.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you, Arianna Huffington, for being with us. Again, we did call the Schwarzenegger campaign repeatedly to get a spokesperson on, but they did not return our calls. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the Immigrant Freedom Rides, Dan Berrigan, will also be speaking to the ambassador of Venezuela. Stay with us.
Representation, we want voting representation, we want voting representation, we want voting representation,
we want
voting representation, we want voting
representation,
we want voting representation,
we want
voting representation,
we want
voting representation,
we want
voting
representation,
we want voting representation.
We want the vote. Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Well, Juan, in Washington, the story of the blowing of the cover of the CIA operative continues. It looks like the Justice Department, John Ashcroft, says he does not want an independent prosecutor. The Democrats are calling for one. But we wanted to go back in time to a time when John Ashcroft supported an independent prosecutor. It's October 4th, 1997, and this is, interestingly enough, from CNN's Evans and Novak show, when Roland Evans was alive and Novak was off that day. The issue was allegations of fundraising violations by Al Gore. Ashcroft said, "The truth of the matter is that if the law has been violated, we should be able to ascertain that. We can if we have an independent person without a conflict of interest." Roland Evans said, "The attorney general has shaved down all the allegations of Vice President Gore, apparently down to one single allegation, which telephone he used to make these fundraising calls from. Do you really think that alone is worthy of a special prosecutor?" Ashcroft. "You know, a single allegation can be most worthy of a special prosecutor. If you're abusing government property, if you're abusing your status in office, it can be a single fact that makes the difference on that. So on my own view is that there are plenty of things which should have caused Attorney General Janet Reno a long time ago to appoint a special prosecutor, an independent investigator. We asked for that on March the 13th of this year in letters from Republican members of the Judiciary Committee, and she's in a bad position. The man who signs her check is the man she's investigating, and she hasn't been very aggressive about it." That was John Ashcroft in 1997, and now the calls on him. And the conflict of interest with John Ashcroft
is much greater than even with Janet Reno and President Clinton.
That's right. If you go to our website, democracynow.org, we've written a piece about the ties that blind the Ashcroft Rove connection. He was his deputy chief of staff. He worked as a campaign consultant for him for his senatorial and gubernatorial campaigns in Missouri. Rove made money from a push for a stadium in St. Louis that was accomplished that Ashcroft signed off on as governor. The ties go on and on, but he still is refusing.
Well, it shows you that as conditions change with some of these politicians, their principles are mutable in varying conditions.
I also have a serious question about whether reporters who were approached, as opposed to asking a question, but reporters who were approached by these, quote, senior administration officials, who then leaked that Joe Wilson, who had exposed the Niger uranium Saddam link, that his wife was a CIA operative, why not one of them come forward? Because that is a story in itself, that the administration wanted to smear this man by exposing his wife as a CIA operative. People talk about journalistic ethics and protecting sources, but this was not necessarily a source. This was someone in the administration that wanted to expose
this woman. That's part of the problem that you have historically in the press, that the person may not have been a source for this particular story, but may have been a future source or a past source, and a reporters in attempting to protect those sources, sometimes they allow these kinds of things to go on when they shouldn't. And that's the problem you have when you depend so much on unnamed sources. I know we were talking about this yesterday, and I mentioned the whole situation with Pat Buchanan when he was an editor at the St. Louis Globe many, many years ago, and when J. Edgar Hoover was attempting to release information as an unnamed source to a variety of newspapers around the country against Martin Luther King and the allegations of Martin Luther King's womanizing and the fact that the FBI had bugged Martin Luther King's hotels. And Patrick Buchanan was the only newspaper editor in America that actually published some of those investigations and, that the FBI had done. Many others refused to do so, but they also did not report at the time that J. Edgar Hoover was involved in this campaign. So, yes, there is a certain complicity of the press sometimes in an attempt to protect their sources for future stories, not necessarily on that particular story. They won't report a real story of manipulation of information.
I call it the journalistic access of evil. And it has to be challenged. And that the reason senior Bush administration officials or any administration officials do this kind of thing is because they thrive in this culture of access, and they know that the reporters depend on it in the future. Well, you're listening to Democracy Now! As we move on now to another issue, and that is the major freedom ride that has been taking place over this last week. 900 immigrants riding across the country. For the past 2 weeks, hundreds of immigrants around the country have been staging immigrant workers' freedom rides to call for better working conditions for undocumented workers. The rides, inspired by the original civil rights freedom riders, took place to protest segregation in the 60s. Some 900 travelers and 18 buses have visited nearly 100 sites throughout the country in a nationwide demonstration advocating for reforms, including the legalization of undocumented workers in the United States. Riders made up of a diverse crowd, including Mexicans, Bangladeshis, undocumented workers, Somalis, longtime as well U.S. citizens. The riders are pushing for better conditions for legal as well as illegal immigrants. Their four-point agenda focuses on workplace policies, civil liberties, faster reunification of families, as well as official status for illegal workers. The AFL-CIO is among the sponsors of this week's rides. Paul Harrington of Northeastern University's Center for Labor Market Studies says, quote, "It's important for people to really start thinking through what contributions we expect immigration to make to American society and what society then owes immigrants."
Others, however, disagree. A spokesman for the Federation for American Immigration Reform says, quote, "What this really should be called is the free ride, because what they want is freedom from playing by the rules," end of quote. So this week's bus rides, prayer vigils, and rallies also come at a time when the so-called war on terrorism has stalled talks of such steps as creating a new guest worker program to address illegal employment and border crossings. Organizers are quick to point out that some of the riders are illegal immigrants who face being deported, but riders said any risk is worth it. Organizers also say that the 15 buses of the Freedom Riders are scheduled to go today to Liberty State Park in Jersey City for a large rally, and then to Flushing Meadow tomorrow, where more than 100,000 immigrants and their supporters are expected to converge.
We're joined by Pramila Jayapal, who's Executive Director of the Hate Free Zone of Washington and co-chair of the Seattle Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride Coalition, and Ahmed Noor, who is an immigrant from Somalia in the United States since 1997. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Welcome to New York. Your ride has been how long now?
We've been on the road for 10 days now. Tomorrow is going to be kind of the big final day. It's been an incredible experience. I think, you know, this is really the first time we've seen this kind of national mobilization fighting for immigrant rights and immigrant justice. We're seeing a remarkable coalition. Unions, AFL-CIO, reversing a longstanding position that they've had, really based on employer sanctions and protectionism, really coming out to the forefront now and saying we're going to support immigrant rights, coming together with the civil rights groups and immigrant rights groups. It's just been phenomenal.
Well, actually, we covered about, I guess it was 1996, the big immigration march in Washington that Pacifica covered live at the time. But I think this is now getting into many of the different communities, obviously, through the bus ride approach. And what's been the reception at the various cities you've been stopping in?
Well, it's been amazing. You know, we have stopped, I think, in total at over 105 cities. And we've gone into small communities across the country, and I think one of the things we're trying to show is these are not isolated issues. These are issues that apply to people all over the country, small communities, large communities. And the reception has been fabulous. We've had a tremendous host response in each of the cities, sometimes 300, 400 people coming out who have never been at a rally before. I think the kind of political power that we were building as we were crossing the country is one of the most exciting pieces of the ride.
Ahmed Noor, can you tell us your story, why you came to the United States in 1997 from Somalia?
Oh, in 1997, before I came, 1989, civil war broke down in Somalia. And it was very bad civil war, and it destroyed whole Somalia. Then I was considered myself one of to go out, where I can go out to get a peace. So I was one of the luckiest Somali to come here in the United States in 1997.
And what happens once you came here?
When I came here, I seek asylum. And last year, 2002, I get a court date for immigration hearing. Then I present my case without lawyer. I wasn't have any experience for here. Then the judge, immigration judge, doesn't believe me what I said, and he denied my case, and he put me on deportation. Then 14 days after that day, three INS officers come to my house and knock the door. I opened the door. I was in pajama at that time. They told me to dress up, and they are taking me to custody in the INS office headquarters in Seattle. And I dress up, and I was thinking that I'm going to be in a van or a car or something like that. But handcuff me on my hands, on my legs, on my waist, and I've been terrorized, never been cuffed before. And it was very, very bad experience on that day for me, because I never been in police problem in anywhere in Somalia, in here in United States. So it was very bad experience to me that day. Anyway, when they got me into the immigration office, I asked them, where are they gonna taking us? Then they told me, immigration officer told me that they're gonna deport me and other Somalians back to Somalia. Then I asked them, why? They said, you are illegal and you have to go, and the immigration judge put you in deportation. I said, there's no government in Somalia. How are you going to deport me to Somalia? This is illegal. And you don't have to report me. And international law for immigration is, if there is a government or recognized government in that country, you can deport. Or should be another country that accepts you as a refugee. So there was no exception country, and there is no government in Somalia. So that's what I thought, there is nowhere to deport us. Anyway, I asked them again. I keep asking the immigration questions, and they told me they have a travel document for us. And that's another question, that where you get the travel document? Because there was no government since 1991. Anyway, they told me that they're going to take us, me and other four guys, to somewhere in Texas, and after 1 week, we're going to be deported to Somalia. And one of those four guys with me in that jail heard about hate-free zone campaign, and he called them, and hate-free zone go to lawyers, and the lawyers volunteer their time, their mind, without no charge, to stop this illegal deportation for the Somalis. And that affect me, another 2,700 Somalis in nationwide, and they succeed to stop that deportation.
And said no Somalis can be deported.
Right, and we actually won. We won in district court. We started with individual habeas corpus petitions for the five, but we started getting calls from around the country, people saying, you know, we have Somalis that are in a similar situation facing imminent deportation. We were literally FedExing habeas petitions to other states, and so we finally realized we needed to file a class action lawsuit. Did that, won in district court. The INS appealed it in the Ninth Circuit, and just 2 weeks ago we won in the Ninth Circuit as well.
And the Ninth Circuit, on September 18th, barred the deportation of any Somalis from the United States.
Yes, yeah. But the important thing to remember here is that we still have not received the names of the 2,700 people that are covered by this class action lawsuit. We know that the government has them. They've told us that there are 2,700 people that would fall under this classification. Both the district court judge as well as the Ninth Circuit panel has requested that the government provide us those names. We still don't have those names.
And Ahmed, how long did you spend in detention altogether?
I spent 19 days. But in 2002, early February that year, there was 30 Somalis being deported back home to Somalia. And as soon as they returned, two of them being killed immediately. Mm. One of them from Seattle.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. I know tomorrow in Flushing Meadow, hundreds of thousands of people are expected to be there in Queens. WBAI will be broadcasting live, great. Pacifica Radio, the event. Again, welcome to New York. We've been speaking to Ahmed Noor, immigrant from Somalia, who remains in the United States based on a decision, a court decision made just 2 weeks ago. Somalis cannot be deported from the United States. And Pramila Jayapal, executive director of the Hate Free Zone Campaign of Washington, one of the organizers of the Immigrant Freedom Rides. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we speak to the Venezuelan ambassador and Dan Barragan. Stay with us.
God of the poor man, this is how the day began. Eight co-defendants, I, Daniel Barragan. Oh, and only a layman. Batch of napalm. We pulled the draft files out. We burned them in the parking lot. Better the files than the bodies of children. They had no right before the love of you. Suffering Tom in Guatemala, Philip in New Orleans. Oh, it's a long road from law to justice. I went to Vietnam, I went for peace. They dropped their bombs right where my government knew.
Dar Williams singing I Have No Right, and we'll be speaking with Dan Barragan in just a minute. But first, we go to Venezuela. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez last week called on the United States to crack down on what he described as Cuban and Venezuelan terrorists training in Florida to kill him. Last week, Chavez canceled a planned trip to the United States because of security threats. Meanwhile, a recent report in U.S. News and World Report titled Terror Close to Home charges Venezuela's emerging as, quote, a potential hub of terrorism in the Western Hemisphere. The article claims Chavez has provided assistance to Islamic fundamentalists. The magazine claims Venezuela has given social security-like cards to thousands of foreigners, including many from Middle Eastern nations, including Syria, Pakistan, Egypt, and Lebanon. The U.S. government has warned that by giving out these ID documents, terrorists could more easily obtain Venezuelan passports and U.S. visas.
The report in U.S. News and World Report also claims that U.S. intelligence officials are investigating whether a Venezuelan of Arab descent has ties to any of the September 11th hijackers. One official described the individual, Hakim Mohamed Al-Dia Fatah, as a person of interest. The article goes on to claim close ties between Chavez's government and the Colombian rebel group FARC. Well, to respond to these charges, we're joined today by Bernardo Alvarez, Venezuela's ambassador to the United States.
Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hey, good morning.
Well, can you start off telling us why President Chavez did not come, as was planned, to the United Nations to address the General Assembly?
Well, you know, there are, of course, always evaluations that the head of state, they make. And in that case, the information we have from the palace of Miraflores in Venezuela is that there were some security concerns. And that came along with a few months ago, and recently there were some reports in Florida newspapers of former Venezuelan military and training in camps in Florida. This is what the newspaper said. To promote an invasion or to promote any actions against Venezuela. So we have sent the U.S. the ambassador in Venezuela that information, and we are waiting for a response from the U.S. government. If you remember, a few months ago there was report that an organization called Judicial Watch was suing the Venezuelan government on behalf of the victims of the September 11, because they say that President Chavez has given $1 million to Al-Qaeda. A Venezuelan ambassador to India, Walter Marquez, came here to the U.S., to United Nations, to Washington, and even to Miami, to present the proof that we, in fact, gave $1 million to the United Nations Office for the Refugees, totally the contrary. And we also gave that information to the FBI, and we are still waiting for an investigation from the FBI, because that was some news coming from people in Florida.
Could you give us your reaction to these sensational charges in U.S. News and World Report that Venezuela has become, in essence, a hotbed for terrorists from other parts of the world stay in your country?
Yeah, when you look at the article firsthand, you think that you are probably looking at a movie, you know. But I'm the Venezuelan ambassador to the U.S. I haven't received any complaint or request of information by the U.S. government. And it's the same format that we have seen lately. For example, Margarita Island being training camp for the Al-Qaeda or whatever. It's like having a terrorist camp in Cancun in Mexico. No? This is a resort. It's a small island, and there is no possibility whatsoever to train anybody there. There are no military forces in Margarita Island. And the whole idea that we are able to give IDs to thousands of people from the Middle East, and then they get their visas and they come to the U.S., so you probably have to blame the U.S. embassy in Venezuela rather than the Venezuelan government. So I think if you look at that, there are no proof and confirmed rumors, the same story. What worries us is that they use information supposedly coming from the U.S. officials. And this is what we have said. We are not the aggressors here, and we would like the U.S. government to respond on that thing, because they quote highly credible sources from the intelligence and the political branches of the U.S. government. And we have asked through the diplomatic channels, the U.S. government to respond on that.
What about the situation right now in Venezuela, the political situation, especially after the Supreme Court there has ordered that the referendum, the recall referendum petition, had to be redone by getting new signatures? What has been the situation as the opposition there attempts to gather new signatures for a new attempt at a recall?
Yes, I think the situation after the march, because we cannot forget that the members of the opposition, and we have said that there are important non-democratic groups in the opposition, they try to stop the country. They try to stop oil production, which is the heart of the Venezuelan economy. And we have been recovering from that economic damages, and we have been stabilizing the political situation. And all we want is that all parties should play, keeping in mind the Constitution. So there is not extra constitutional way out of any political crisis in Venezuela. Now we have an impartial electoral body. Those people looked at the signatures, and if you might see that nobody has reacted against that. Because, I mean, imagine that you are going to recall a mandate of an official with signatures that were collected by a private firm, and they were kept for, I don't know, 6 months. So I think this is something that we is over now. And what is important, we have the electoral body, we have the norms for collecting the signatures, and there is a constitution. If you allow me, this is one of the points we have been discussing with the U.S. administration, because we said the referendum is not the result of any political agreement between the government and the opposition. The president of the Supreme Court came to the U.S. and he said, in the case that the government and the opposition should sign a political agreement to hold a referendum, it will be unconstitutional because the referendum is the right of the Venezuelan people to recall the mandate of any official elected official. So what is important now that everything is clear, we have an electoral body, and there are not only they have been requests for the recall referendum for the president, but also the recall referendum for state governors, for members of the National Assembly, and this is what is democracy about.
I want to thank you very much, Bernardo Alvarez, for joining us. Bernardo Alvarez is the Venezuelan ambassador to the United States, again, Hugo Chavez, who had intended to come to the United Nations last week, did not, citing security threats. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move into our last segment. Legendary peace activist Phil Berrigan would have been 80 years old tomorrow. He and his brother Dan Berrigan became household names in 1968 when they and seven others entered a draft board in Catonsville, Maryland, removed hundreds of A1 draft files that were being used to send young men to Vietnam. They took the files to the parking lot and burned them with homemade napalm. Their action became known as the Catonsville Nine. It was not Berrigan's first time in prison. It wouldn't be his last. In fact, Phil Berrigan would go on to spend nearly a decade behind bars for his nonviolent direct actions against war and nuclear weapons. In 1980, Phil Berrigan, his brother Dan, and six others entered the General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and hammered on nuclear warheads with household hammers. This began the movement that would become Phil's life work, the Plowshares Movement.
This weekend, hundreds of people are gathering in New York City to remember the life of Phil Berrigan. Among those who will be speaking this Saturday, historian Howard Zinn, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, Phil's wife, Liz McAllister, his daughter, Frida, and his brother, the Reverend Daniel Berrigan, who joins us now in our studios.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dan. So, your thoughts. You lost your brother in December. He died of cancer at home at the Jonah House Resistance Community in Baltimore, Maryland. Tomorrow he would be 80 years old. As you reflect on his life and your life with him together.
Well, Amy, I should really begin with an act of gratitude to you for being at our side in Philip's last week on Earth and being our very dear friend. Well, I remember a quotation out of St. Augustine's Confessions with regard to the loss of a very dear friend of his. And he said in the original Latin that this friend was the dimidium anime mea, the half of my soul. And I thought of that phrase with regard to Philip. It's very tough this first year because I'm retracing so many of his steps. I was in California for a retreat that he gave just a year ago and met with the friends whose memory of him is quite green and vivid and painful. And then Liz and myself did a retreat in the Poconos just 2 weeks ago where Philip had joined us a year ago. And the three of us had led the retreat. So the first year is very rough. And though I'm very grateful as well. We had some great years.
Those first protests that you were involved with, which one of you got the other one into it?
Well, I was always tardy. And Philip, when he would get exasperated, would say, "There goes that liberal again." I was teaching at Cornell in 68 when Philip decided, after being convicted for pouring blood on draft files a year before, came to Cornell to say, "We're going to do it again." And he was awaiting sentencing at the time, and this kind of petrified me and eventually set me in motion when he said, "Are you going to join us?" And, of course, I had sort of decided that my role was to help young people decide about their future, whether it would be exile or jail.
You're Jesuit priests.
Yeah. And it took me a few days to get into a new whole phase of resistance that he was quite at home with.
And eventually I just wrote and said, you know, I'm in. And knowing that my life would never be the same and that Cornell would be a past option.
And as you reflect back on your sense of the impact of his example and his life's work on on the resistance movement in the country or the conscience of the nation?
Well, I think that's very tough to evaluate so soon. My experience is that it really takes a decade for somebody to be set in place in history, especially in a history as painful and as tormented, really, as the peace movement has been. I would go very slow in trying to say something this close to his death about that. I think time will tell.
When you go back to the times we just described, going back to 1968, to the Catonsville Nine, you and Phil going into the draft board, entering, taking out the A1 draft files, burning them, why with napalm?
Well, napalm was being used against civilians in Vietnam, and we had horrendous photos across the world of children being burned with this stuff, which simply cannot be rubbed off or easily dealt with. It cuts to the bone. And we thought this would be a very powerful symbol to use against these files, which we looked upon as hunting licenses. And that applying them to the source of the war's legitimacy that these files represented might speak to people, which I think it did. I think it did in a very wide sense.
And the King of Prussia, the General Electric incident, or the protest. I remember being a reporter at the Philadelphia Daily News in those days.
Uh-huh.
That was quite a big news in that area because General Electric was a major employer in the suburban Philadelphia area. How did that develop in terms of the decision to go there?
Well, we met, I think, over a period of months, beginning in the spring of 80, about that whole question, you know, because these manufacturing centers were so anonymous and so well hidden that people didn't know they existed, and we had never really thought seriously about going to the source in that way. And then we learned through Daniel Ellsberg and other experts that they were secretly making this first strike nuclear weapon, which was useful only if it initiated a nuclear war, the Mark 12A, as it was called at that time. It was not a Hiroshima-type bomb. It was a bomb to be used against deep emplacements of the enemy before he was able to discharge his weapons. So it was clearly provocative and horrendous in a kind of a doomsday project that General Electric was in on. Well, with that background and all, we knew these weapons were being, the warhead was being assembled in King of Prussia and then shipped off to Amarillo, Texas for its payload. So the weapons as they existed in Pennsylvania were harmless. And we found they were also quite vulnerable. They were made of kind of eggshell and made to withstand the heat of re-entry into the atmosphere, but they were very perishable and vulnerable, and a little crack of a household hammer could break the egg.
Well, Dan Berrigan, I want to thank you for being with us. It'll be a most unusual gathering tomorrow with you. Ramsey Clark, Howard Zinn, you and Howard Zinn went to North Vietnam. Ramsey Clark was Attorney General of the United States at the time under Lyndon Johnson, but also your sister-in-law, Liz McAllister, and Frieda Berrigan, Phil's daughter. Very interesting event tomorrow night. I'll be there as well at Judson Church. Also, Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Producer, Judson Church here in New York at Washington Square Park, 7 o'clock on Saturday night, on the day that would have been the 80th birthday of Phil Berrigan. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul Qudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pravay Sharma. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks to Mike DeFilippo. We burn them in